still probably have it.
Okay, we need to resume our meeting.
No, I have not. Very good.
And our first agenda item after break is an update on watershed analysis. Darren.
I misread the agenda. I was thinking I was upset. Darren Kramer, Forest Practices Division Manager. I'm here with Jim because Jim's going to talk about a two-part. So we had a two-part item, and Jim's going to talk about the second part. My update is related to what we've been talking about for the last several weeks and months, and that's the administrative processes that DNR is working on related to watershed analysis, as well as the agreement that was announced at the March special board meeting, the agreement with, between the department and warehouse. So on the first item, we're continuing to work on the prioritization criteria and the review process that's underway, along with many other items on the plate. So we're continuing to work on that. Don't have anything for you today, but again, am intending to have a complete prioritized list as well as a review process by the late summer or August meeting. And then the agreement with Weyerhaeuser that was announced at the March special board meeting, we are continuing to work on fleshing out the details of that agreement. We have a draft agreement written up, and not quite ready to share it today, but will be very soon. But it's underway. It should be finalized, I expect, within the next few days to a week or so. And then the next item is an update on the proposal from the last meeting, the last board meeting, and Jim's going to update you on that.
So the board last meeting adopted a proposal to send a proposal through the adaptive management process and requested an update, and so that's what this is. The board, through Commissioner Goldmark, sent me, the Adaptive Management Administrator, the proposal from the board on behalf of the board. I was able to turn that around and do my job, which is basically to evaluate those proposals, address a number of questions, and then make recommendations to policy on which track those proposals should go down, whether they go down the policy track or down the research track. My recommendation to them followed almost literally the recommendations that were in the proposal that the board adopted. Policy chose to keep it in the policy track. They accepted the proposal. They've already developed a subgroup. That subgroup has not met yet. Policy just met this last Thursday. That subgroup then will develop a charter and develop a schedule. There was a long discussion about a schedule because of the degree of urgency that some members of the board expressed. That will be coming after the charters, but that will come with the charter, and the board will be informed later. They have a target date of December, but hope to have it done no later than May of next year, but again, with the target date of December.
That's it. Okay. Questions?
Darren, in the prioritization and review process that you are developing, as you discussed right at the beginning, is that a DNR staff process? Are there stakeholder involvements, or will there be some opportunity for that along the
certainly,
way?
Certainly. We'll do a good fair amount of the staff work in developing some draft criteria as well as the review process. But we fully intend to vet that with all interested stakeholders before it becomes final.
Any feeling of time for when that might be?
Again, I hope we can have a final review process and a final prioritized list by August.
So then the stakeholder participation is going to be happening over the summer then?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Other questions for Darren or Jim? Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
Yep. Our next agenda item is an update on Clean Water Act assurances. Stephen Bernath and Mark Hicks, Department of Ecology.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Stephen Bernath with the Department of Ecology.
And I'm Mark Ricks, also with the Department of Development.
I'm just going to introduce the topic. Mark continues to be the brains and the workhorse behind this effort. So the update to you this quarter is a little more detailed this because we are attempting on an annual basis what we've decided to tweak the milestones where it seems reasonable given staffing and budget considerations, and then report to you on our success in meeting those milestones. So with that, I'll let Mark take it from there and highlight those things that we think you should be aware of.
Okay, thanks, Steven. As Steven said, this is a little different than our previous quarterly updates. It's a lot longer, and part of that reason is essentially about a year has passed since we came up with our list of milestones. We thought it was a really good time to give you a more detailed explanation on the status of all the milestones. If you just look at the dates to when they're due, you can see that some of them have not been met. In many cases, there's good reasons for that, and there's also a good reason to celebrate the large number of them that are completed or almost completed. And so I wanted to make sure that you had an opportunity to actually review each one of the milestones and see an explanation on where it is in the process of being developed. That's part of the reason. And this is a great time to be doing these longer updates because it follows on the CMER budget and planning process, which is a time where CMER dives into its studies in greater detail and kind of evaluates where they really are right now and how close they are to getting to the next stage in development from study design to implementation to final reports. One of the things that's come out in this process is, and we knew this was going to happen when we put together the milestones, is that there would be some fine-tuning and learning as we went along. We realized that some projects that we had listed as a milestone to be done first really would be better if it was done second. And that happened in terms of our discussions with how these projects interrelate with one another conceptually, and that one can form a better precursor to the other, and thus we save money and get a better product overall. So we knew that as we move forward, we'd be making changes. But we take these milestones very seriously, and we want to make sure that any changes that we do make are well documented. So that's the other reason for giving you a more lengthy package. It's because it serves essentially as a formal notification that there are changes being made to the dates at which things are due in time. Now, although we changed some dates, and if people did a real cursory look, they'd see some dates move further out into the future, it really doesn't signal any kind of a relaxation in the assurances at all. All it really is that recognition that it is going to actually take a little longer. So, for example, for some of the CMER projects, we had realized that the prior date that it was expected to be completed didn't actually include some steps. It was missing steps, such as data analysis. Well, that takes a lot of time. Actually, if you do a 7 to 10 year research project, you just can't write it up in a few weeks. It takes something close to a year to get it written up and through the final approval process through the CMER process. So those kind of adjustments are necessary so that we have more accurate targets to be shooting for. So that's what most of those changes are all about. I think, by and large, Ecology is pretty happy with the pace at which we're moving forward and trying to meet these milestones. We've gotten a huge amount of support from DNR in terms of taking some leadership over some of the milestones. As I've said before in our quarterly updates, that has not changed. It is important that that continue, however, because as we start to slide a little bit behind the time schedule on some of the milestones that are past due, it'll become harder to then keep up with the schedule for the ones that are still to come. And we have a tendency, I've noticed in this program, to underestimate the amount of work necessary to accomplish things. That being in this cooperative world that we're working in makes it so that many meetings are often required to get all the issues aired and look at the alternatives and then finally get something written into the process. So even though some milestone may be 3 to 5 months out, it's going to be important for us to look at what kind of milestone that is and how much work it's going to take, and then put the lead time into getting them started. So it's just kind of a heads up. Things are going really good. Doesn't mean that, in fact, there can't be any problems. I'm sure we're still going to find some, there's some sticky mud out there for us. But things are going well. College's biggest concern at this point, which I'm sure you're all aware of, is the long-term budget situation. Right now, we're sitting pretty good with the adaptive management program for another year, but after that, it looks like we're in a lot of trouble. So we do need to find a stable long-term funding source, otherwise the program will not be able to meet the assurances or meet any of the expectations for which it was established. And at this time, I'll take any questions you might have.
I wanted to just add one final comment. Our ability on some of these milestones to move forward and keep on track is in direct proportion to the available staff time to do them. And so I would caution the board, not that we don't want to serve you and provide you all the staff work we can, that when we have multiple number one priorities, something usually gets put on a back burner for a while. So we just want to caution the board that this is still a high priority for us, and we are looking at all the other work we're doing with you and for you as we move forward.
A couple of comments. I really do appreciate the thorough report and highlighting those things which are changed and those things which are completed and moving of deadlines and timelines and so on. It's very helpful. I asked question Stephen before the meeting began relative to this update and the CMR work plan, which we are going to be reviewing later on in the meeting, as to whether the two are consistent with each other. Does the CMR work plan get to those critical questions that the Clean Water Assurances have asked? And I won't put words in your mouth, but it sounded like, yes, we were pretty well on track. The difficulty in reading between the various documents is that things are titled a little bit differently or termed a little bit differently, so it's not a direct translation from one report to the other. It's not bad. You kind of sort it out, but I don't know if you have any other comment on that, either one of you, but that's a critical question for this board as we approve those that CMR work plan. Are we meeting the requirements and the needs for the Clean Water Act assurances?
The issue of actually lining those up so that the CMR work plan actually matches the Clean Water Act assurances priorities was integrated in all the discussions that occurred this last year, and this is about as close as we can get for an annual update. So I think they're lined up very well.
Thank you.
Other questions for Stephen or Mark? Thank you, gentlemen. Next on our agenda is a report from Forest and Fish Policies RMAP subgroup. Stephen and Tom Robinson, co-chairs.
I'm Tom Robinson. I'm the TIM Program Manager for Washington State Association of Counties and co-chair of the Forest and Fish Policy Group.
So, ladies and gentlemen, what we want to do is, this is a topic that has not been before you before, and we potentially have some things coming your way for the August meeting, so we felt we needed to get you informed and updated. In your packet, you should have received this morning a charter for something called the Road Policy Work Group. For those of you who are maybe not as familiar with the Forest Practices HCP or the Forest and Fish Report, the RMAP, or Road Maintenance Abandonment Plan Policy and Rules, was adopted as a key cornerstone of the updated rules in 2000 and 2001. The idea being that while we are waiting for shade and other riparian resources to recover along stream sides, which is a decadal thing, that one of the things we could do in the short term is make a commitment to make sure that all roads were in compliance with the rules, making sure we don't have sediment going in the creek, et cetera. And that was basically codified in something called the Road Maintenance Abandonment Plan rules. What's happened, and basically the commitment was for landowners, particularly large landowners, to get on a plan. They used the first 5 years of a 15-year planning cycle to figure out what roads, do a full inventory of their roads, figure out what they needed to do, and then do an even flow analysis of doing worst first and figuring out what they had to do over 15 years to complete that. We are now 10 years into that 15-year plan. However, the economy has not been very favorable to the timber industry in the last couple of years, and the industry has asked that we consider an extension of the RMAP process, not because they are in concern about whether what they're doing is right, it's just a basic cash flow issue. And so they brought that to our policy group. We formed a subcommittee, and this charter reflects the work that that subcommittee is doing. And I just want to highlight a few things about what we're hoping to bring you in August. One is we're hoping to bring you some proposal on whether we think it's appropriate and under what conditions to grant an extension of the RMAP timeline. Second, we are also looking at how to better track how our maps are being accomplished. Another thing we are trying to do is to re-engage the small landowners in this effort, particularly through getting better funding for the FFF2P program, which is the program to fund and replace fish barriers on small landowner holdings. We are also trying to look at how we can better show in the 2013 legislative report that DNR proposed to the legislature how our strategy on small landowner checklist RMAPs are progressing and whether that's a successful program or not. And we have included a couple of other things. One is the counties who own a lot of the bridges and so forth downstream from all the forest landowners, small and large alike, sometimes don't have the money to replace those barriers. So we are looking at a package, a funding package, to try and get the counties better funding to do their work. And we are also, if we happen to have the opportunity, we don't know whether this is feasible or not, look for low interest loans to help the large landowners bridge the gap over the next couple of years. Finally, the only other comment I would add, and then I'll turn it over to Tom, and I just lost my, I'll just turn it over to Tom.
It is the policy work group's intent to try to have materials to you for your consideration in August, and if rulemaking should result be a result of this, we would hope that we can jump ahead a bit and prepare documents and that sort of thing to facilitate a rapid movement on this. This is an important thing to the industry. Early action is something that we've been requested to focus on, so we're doing everything in our power to make sure that that happens. We'd be willing to take any questions you might have at this time.
I do remember my last point. That we were trying to do this in the context of no unintended consequences.
And in fact, have looked out ahead to things that we think might be impacted and specifically avoid those. And a lot of that's illustrated in the chart. Questions?
I need to read through that, the rest of it, but I just wanted to highlight for the rest of the board. So it's your understanding that the group is in agreement that, as you have under the purposes here, that the recommendations aren't going to change fundamental objectives about protecting fish habitat or maintaining or achieving Clean Water Act assurances. We're just looking at a, I'm not quite sure about that.
Correct.
I don't expect the group knows how that's
correct.
Addressed
there is agreement on that. And of course, people are concerned, does that mean there won't be protection of the public resources in the interim? And as always, when a forest landowner harvests, the roads that they're using have to be in compliance. So that doesn't go away. This is, if you look at some kind of obligation over a 15-year timeline, what we're talking about is having that same obligation perhaps over a longer period of time, so that we can recognize the economic situation, still accomplish the goal, though. The other thing that I would forgot to left out is this isn't just about private landowners. This is also about the two major state forest landowners who, both DNR and Fish and Wildlife, have lands that need to comply with the RMAP program.
As well as this is a watershed approach, folks. That's the, I think that's the key. We, you know, as you look at the activities that are going on under our maps and realize that the landowners and the state land management agencies are upstream generally of the population centers, opening these streams up to fish passage and removing these barriers to fish passage is only effective if the fish can get to the barrier in the first place. And so bringing the counties into this picture and taking a hard look at inventorying the problem at that level, what we've realized is that the county road system and the small landowner road systems are basically an overlay of one another. The small landowner roads generally connect to county roads, so we need to address those barriers to the mouth, in effect. And this is our best attempt to make sure that we're taking a look at this at a, from a watershed perspective.
I just want to be clear on the steps ahead here. So in August, you hope to have a proposal to the board to give to policy to start the review process of a possible rule. Is that what you're saying?
No, okay. Not quite. Good. So we also have a staff group working on this to collect all the existing data.
Yeah, I saw that.
That's going to feed into the policy subgroup. We will take that plus provide a proposal that will go to policy hopefully in June.
Okay, that's happening soon.
And then,
you're waiting for the
and
board.
Then between June and July, hopefully policy will approve something that can be forwarded to you in time and in a timely way before the August meeting so that you can be prepared to
start to
take appropriate action at that time.
Okay, any other questions for Stephen and Tom? Thank you. Now we come to public comment on the CEMER 2011 work plan and budget. No one signed up for a comment. Is there anyone in the room who would like to provide comment to the board on CEMER's 2011 work plan and budget? Chris?
Sure, just a general comment. As CEMER co-chair, that every year we go through this work plan and we revise it. I just add that this year we had some substantial revisions and increased the size of the work plan from about 100 pages to 160 or so. But there's a large section there now that looks at what we're calling a link to adaptive management. And one of the purposes of that change in the work plan was to help link, if you will, policy into our research a little better and help facilitate the interaction between the policy work group and the CEMER work group. I mean, picking up a 100-page technical document from CEMER on what we're doing and wading through it can be a big task for anybody, board included, as well as policy. So some of the major revisions we did this year were designed to help help policy out in that regard and look at what, how our research is linked to some of the critical questions in the HCP. And I just want to thank everyone at SEMR, all SEMR members, and my co-chair, Terry Jackson, for pulling a lot of the workload on that and making sure that this got to you folks on time this year. Thank you.
Thanks. Is there anyone else who would like to provide comments to the board on this action item? Okay. Then we'll move into a presentation on the SEMR 2011 Work Plan and Budget by our Adaptive Management Administrator, Jim Hotbeck.
I was just reminded that I should remind the board what SEMR stands for, particularly for the new members. It stands for Cooperative Monitoring, Evaluation, and Research Committee. DNR has a lot of acronyms, just like most other agencies. So the SEMR is the research side, again, the research and monitoring side. What I want to do today is I'm going to cover both the SEMR work plan as well as budget. So I'm going to start off talking about the work plan first and then do budget last, because I want to talk about revenue. And talk about the projects as well as associated costs. Before that, I do that, I want to talk a little bit about how the work plan is organized. Like Chris said, it is approximately 170 pages now, so it's very lengthy. I've been in my position for 5 months at one time. Prior to 5 months ago, I thought it was too long. I didn't understand it. I didn't know how it was organized. And just a mass of material. It turns out that actually it's a very, very good reference document once you figure out the system. So in the back, one of your handouts is this chart. And I think Darren went through this with you last year, but I'm going to do this every year just as a reminder. If you look at the table of contents in the work plan is divided up by rule groups. For example, the type F for fish waters, type N for non-fish waters, roads rule group, wetlands rule group, and so forth. So the first thing is it's subdivided by rule group. If you look at this chart, at the top, it's got rule group A. And then it has critical questions. So the work plan itself has critical questions associated with that rule group. And then under each rule group, we have four programs. Okay, four programs. They relate to rule tools, effectiveness monitoring, intensive monitoring, or extensive monitoring. And then under each one of those programs, we have a number of projects. Now, right now in the work plan, we have 95 projects. Some of them completed, some of them ongoing, and some of them planned. So we're not actually working on 95 projects all at the same time. I think we're actually working on 14, 10 currently, and we're going to propose four new ones, which would be 14. So the work plan, as daunting as it may seem at first when you look at it, you look at the table of contents, it's not as bad as it is. If you kind of go by this chart. Any questions on organization of the plan itself?
Okay. I don't have a question, but I just appreciate the effort you put into making it flow. It's taken me a little bit of time to kind of go between things. But once you get it figured out in terms of how you presented it, it's very useful.
It's, and one of the uses is, like I said, I've only been in the position for 5 months, but right away when the budgeting issue came up, we had a lot of questions about, well, which projects could we put through the EPA funding programs, for example. It was very easy for me to go into the table of contents, find the project, and then get a description of the project, the status of the project, and immediately I had something I could send to people. And it was that quick. But it just took a little bit of time to figure out what the system was. I've already mentioned there's two new, actually I mentioned earlier this morning and Chris mentioned just a little bit ago, we have two new sections. One is that projects functions table that I talked about earlier in the staff report. That's at the end. That will be updated every year along with the rest of the SEMA work plan. And then we added a new section called Link to Adaptive Management, which actually took quite a bit of work on the part of SEMA. Three sections added under Link to Adaptive Management for each program. We now have knowledge gain, identified gaps in that knowledge, and recommendations for addressing gaps. So as we go through our research projects, and we go through our programs and complete our programs, hopefully the gaps get smaller and smaller until we have enough information that we would be able to come to the board and either recommend changes in rules or even recommend no changes in rules, that we validated the rules as they are. That again, that was a fairly large issue that SEMA took on and the co-chairs took on. If you look at page 15 through 16 of the plan, you'll see the projects themselves, the ongoing as well as proposed projects. And we have 10 ongoing projects, and we have 4 proposed new projects, and the new projects are highlighted by the stars in front of them. So for example, the Type N experimental buffer treatment project in soft rock lithologies would be a new one. Eastside Type N forest hydrology would be new. Testing the accuracy of unstable landform identification would be another new one. And then wetlands mitigation effectiveness. Those projects all together add up to about $1.7 million in cost. So any questions in particular as I go through here about either the ongoing or the proposed projects? These all, like I believe Mark Hicks just identified, is SEMA and policy about a year and a half ago went through a major reprioritization of their projects in order to line the projects up with the Clean Water Act assurances. So if ongoing projects are not lined up with Clean Water Act, they're still ongoing so that we can finish those. All the new ones are clearly lined up with the priorities under the assurances. Okay.
Yeah. Clarifying question. So it shows here you've got a budget for fiscal year 11 of 1.7. What do you have full funding for that one?
Yes, we do. We have full funding for the 1.7. And I'll get into that a little bit.
And you also have funding for the associated staff costs?
Yes.
For
yes.
2.7. Yes.
So if we go to the bottom of another handout, which should have been the budget table. Which goes out to 2019, I believe.
That's towards the end.
Yes, towards, should be towards the end in a separate section. Correct. Thanks, Wayne. I want to go down to the end of the table where it talks about revenues. I like the revenues. So just above the revenues, you'll notice total expenditures for projects and activities, approximately $2.7 million. About 11 rows up. And then you'll notice total funds available, approximately $2.8 million. And so this year we do have, or we're projecting, I guess I should say, for 2011, to have sufficient funds to pay for both ongoing projects, proposed projects, as well as administration. The problem obviously becomes in 2012, and the reason that we do have sufficient income is because when Darren met with you last May, he had to make projections, for example, on what he thought general fund state would be, where he thought the federal ROC or RCO grant money would be, as well as revenues from the B&O taxes, for the forest fish support account. We had a larger fund balance than we expected, both in the federal RCO monies as well as in the forest fish support account. And so basically, those fund balances have basically saved us through 2011, as well as the money we got from the legislature from the ALEA, the $1.03 million from the ALEA funds. So this year, 2011, next year I should say, next year, 2011, we should be fairly comfortable in terms of being able to meet expenses. Again, the problem becomes in 2012 when we basically will run out of the federal monies, and unless we find other long-term support, revenues are projected to be $1.2 million. $600,000 from general fund state and $600,000 from the forest and fish support. Any questions about revenues? Other than we need help. So let me talk about, if there's no questions, let me just talk a little bit about the grants. You are aware that in March, we submitted three grant applications to the Environmental Protection Agency. They had a request for application. We submitted three. DNR itself developed two and submitted them on behalf of the AMP program, and Department of Ecology submitted one on the part of the AMP program. Unfortunately, we don't hear about success or lack of success until the end of this week. So the timing wasn't very apropos, but we should know Friday or hopefully soon after whether we were successful with any one of those three grants. There should be, we're expecting another round of EPA requests for applications. We expected them earlier this summer, but apparently there were so many applications on the first round that it overwhelmed personnel, EPA personnel, in terms of the review process. And so we don't expect now to hear anything until sometime later this summer about other, at least EPA opportunities for grants.
Jim, what would be the effect of being successful with one or more of those grant applications? Would it allow you to shove money forward in time and close the gap down for 2012?
What it does is because we're allowed to, we don't have to spend all of our general fund state, we have to spend all of our money in the year that it's appropriated. The forest and fish support account, as well as the federal grants, we can carry forward from one year to the next until they're expended out or until the terms are up. This year, because we do have enough money to cover all of our expenses, anything that would come in from grants either could be used for the, could be used for those grants, and what that then would do is allow us to save forest and fish support account money in particular and move it forward for future years.
What's the total dollar amount of the EPA grants
that we submitted? The wetland mitigation, $600,000, with the first year expected to spend $220,000. SEMER management information was $285,000 first year. We spent $163,000. And then the Westside Taipan experimental buffer that DOE put in was $695,000. I forgot to say a minute ago when I was talking about the revenues, the other source of revenues, at least for this year, is the Department of Ecology has voluntarily agreed to provide $100,000 for the soft rock, the Type N experimental buffer soft rock project. It's one of the premier clean watershed insurances projects, and they'd like to get it on board and moving. Any other no questions? So this is a decision item, so we're requesting that the work plan as well as the budget be approved. And again, a question that a while ago, not in this meeting, was asked whether this was a consensus decision, and the answer is yes. Both SEMER, the research side, as well as policy, agreed to the budget and the work plan.
Our teleprompter.
That's good. We cannot have managed that on our own.
Would any board member care to make a motion?
I'll move the Forest Practice Board approve the 2011 CBER work plan and budget as presented.
Second. We have a second?
I'm glad I see it on the screen.
Second. Okay. Discussion.
Question. On the work plan itself, this is page 15 in the handout, at least the one that I'm looking at. And it's probably a generic question, but I'll point to a specific as an example and just see how you might answer the question. In the wetlands rural group, I see there's a wetlands mitigation effectiveness is $157,000. And when I looked at the priorities section, which I can't remember which page that was on, a few pages earlier or after, it ranked somewhat lower than maybe some other projects that don't appear to have floated up to the higher on the actual work plan list.
Were you looking at page 13?
Probably. Yes, I am.
Okay.
Yeah, right. And so, a generic question. It's not meaning to cast any dispersions on that particular study, but so how does the one translate into the other?
I guess that's explainable.
Okay.
Easily explainable. Thank goodness. a few years ago, CEMER ranked projects based on uncertainty associated with the science that went into developing the projects, as well as the risk to the resources if, in fact, the science, let's say, something was lacking in the science. So originally, again, this is 4 or 5 years ago, 6 years ago, I'm not sure when, but all the projects were listed based on uncertainty and risk to resources. A reprioritization occurred a couple of years ago with the Clean Water Act Assurances Review. And so now we have a different priority of projects based on the review than is shown in this table. So this is the original set of priorities based on, again, uncertainty and risk.
Okay.
Thank you.
Other discussion or questions for Jeff? Okay, then I'm going to call a question. The motion has been made and seconded. Would all those in favor please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Okay, we have a unanimous approval of the 2011 work plan and budget.
Mr. Chair, would it be all right if we could get an update maybe after Friday if you find out whether you got your grant money? Just
we
as
can
a matter
ask that an update. Email be sent to us to let us know how that turns out.
It'll be a celebration if we get one.
Well, I think we'll all be happy.
And if this is the same pot that everybody else has been going for, the second round of EPA money is the same, David?
Yeah, I think that's correct.
EPA's schedule for that is to not make a decision until next April, so another year for the second.
Is that right?
The second round.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's an
important. We're working on trying to speed that up.
Thank you.
We are running about 50 minutes ahead of schedule, and with the board's consent, I'd like to keep moving and see if we can get a few more items dispatched before we break for lunch. So next we will have any public comment on CEMER membership. Is there anyone in the room who would like to provide comments to the board on CEMER membership? If not, Jim, I'm going to call you right back up here to talk about that.
Yes, in CEMER, there's a large number of folks who participate in CEMER from the various agencies, the landowners, caucuses, the tribes, the tribal organizations, environmental groups, and so forth. But there's a core set of CEMER members who are voted on by the board. And when consensus can't be arrived at, either in a scientific advisory group or elsewhere within the CEMER process, those are the voting members. Okay? There's a vacancy in the landowner caucus, and the landowner caucus, through WFPA, has requested that A.J. Kroll, be nominated as a member of the board and ask for your approval for that nomination.
Is our teleprompter functioning?
There we go.
Sure, I move that Forest Practices Board approve Table 2 as the current SEMA roster that reflects A.J. Kroll as a core member.
Second. My comment on that is I don't believe that there is any such thing as a core member versus some other kind of member. I believe the board only approves SEMA members. And we have SEMA members and other people who come to SEMA meetings. So if that's correct, I would suggest that we delete the word core from this as a friendly amendment to the motion.
That's fine. That's just been the practice to call the voting members core members because it's pretty typical to have lots of folks attend SEMA meetings that may be outside of the voting members. So it's just by practice.
I'm just trying to tie the board's motion back to the rules. And I don't believe the rules differentiate classes of membership. They're only members
or not.
And not.
Second.
Okay. Any further discussion on this? Okay. If not, I'll call the question. All those in favor of the motion as amended to eliminate the word court, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Okay. Motion is passed. Next agenda item we have is discussion on the business reference guide by Mark Engel.
Good morning again, Mr. Chair and members of the board. It just occurred to me that the bylaws committee is not present today. But the board did form a bylaws committee consisting of the commissioner and board members Carolyn Dobbs and Sherry Fox to review the potential of bylaws for the Forest Practices Board. They did meet on two occasions. And they recognize that Chapter 8 and the rules contains the practices that the formal bylaws would have provided to the board. However, and especially in light of many new board members, these rules are only part of the larger set of rules and statutes that actually govern the Forest Practices Board. Whose primary purpose is to create rules or initiate rulemaking. So the committee requested counsel, Phil Ferrister, to prepare what has become the business reference guide, or what we now call the BRG. This guide includes the statutes and rules that govern the board's actions and procedures pertaining to the public comments and cutoff dates for introduction of agenda items. And at the back of the BRG, there is a chart so that people can look at and I guess gives a date certain as to when things will be made available to both the board and the public. This BRG is really a reflection of what's currently in statute and rule, and so staff recognize that no formal motion needed to be made in order to incorporate the BRG for use by the board. So staff would like to ask that the board consider today allowing staff to post it on the web. However, as a result of one of our two recent special meetings, there were a large number of notes being passed between the general public and board members. This meeting occurred after the last meeting of the subcommittee. So in your memo for the bylaw, or excuse me, the BRG, staff has recommended an insertion into the BRG, which will be projected here in a moment. And the insertion simply states that the board prohibits the passing of written or electronic notes from the general public to its members during meetings, to board members during meetings. So you see that we need to adjust it a little bit. So with that, staff recommends that the board acknowledge the BRG and request staff to post it on the website. I might add that the BRG is an interactive reference guide where if you go on electronically, it has hot links. So when you see the appropriate statute that you need for reference, you need to only click on that and it'll take you directly to the language for that statute. So with that, I'll entertain any questions.
Are you satisfied this language? It does what you're after because it covers written communications, electronic communications, but not people approaching board members during meetings?
Well,
you don't like to be approached.
At least to a board meeting.
That's a good place to stop, Mr. Chair.
Is this the language that staff would really like to run with on this?
I think the language implies that, Mr. Chair. I mean, you have to approach a board member in order to pass them a note. But you wouldn't have to if you were doing an electronic message. So I mean, that was the intent to try to capture the whole universe. I would suggest that we don't necessarily need its board. One or the other would suffice in that statement.
Yeah. Remove the word its. Two board members during meetings.
I have a question. This is just really a statement of what is. It's not, we're not inventing new rules. So as necessary, if there are any clarifications like the passing of notes, that can be added to this.
That's what we're going to go on.
That actually, the proposal here is to add that.
Okay, so should we
do this business reference guide, which will be posted on your webpage. This is not a rule.
Okay, so that
you could also adopt an addition to your procedural rules, but that is a sort of much longer and more involved process and may not be necessary to accomplish your goals.
Yeah. Okay, so that's a little bit more of an action than just saying what rules apply. You're saying, in addition to those that apply, this is another one.
If the board would ever find that this guidance for itself and other members of the public isn't adequate, you could still take the step to initiate rulemaking at some time in the future. You're not certainly foreclosed from doing that.
Well, I might ask a question. So this is basically a guidance based upon the WAC and was adopted by the. It doesn't have the effect of a rule.
No,
in that case, it's simply a guidance,
which is why we're not having this as an action item today. You're looking for concurrence and some direction from the chair and staff. Other thoughts or discussion, Norm?
A question on the table that's at the very last page of this, page 6, that gives some date or timelines. I guess not dates, but timelines for documents and that sort of thing. When we get into discussion as a board, there are often amendments, motions, that sort of thing that come up during the course of a meeting that may not have been something that's prepared in advance. Does this in any way limit or stop that kind of discussion or procedure from what our current practice is?
I believe this is the provides guidance for the submittal of materials which would initiate the conversation. If the board chooses to request additional information or bring forward more information through their discussion, that's possible. Again, this is just the basis from which the board will discuss issues. The preparatory time on the materials.
So this essentially is referring to information from Forest Practices Board staff to board members, not necessarily anything from other members of the public or anything that we might individually bring in.
This is the information that will be made available to both the board and the general public prior to each regular meeting of the board.
Okay. Thank you.
I understand that the subcommittee of the board took up this matter about whether they actually wanted to proceed to rulemaking, but walked down the agenda per this table, and they decided that this was general guidance, but they didn't want to quite go to that point. Is that correct?
Maybe I don't want to be tedious here, but just another going back to this. The prohibition of passing or written or electronic notes to the board members during meetings. I guess the true definition of the meeting starts at 9 and goes till whenever we conclude. And so does that include the discussions and things that may take place during break? Or are you talking, are you only talking about when the board is in session?
I think the intention is when the board is in session, and when the board is on break, it's technically in recess, Council?
Yes.
Okay. So okay. The language would not prohibit that at lunchtime or during the break.
Okay.
So since we're not really talking about an action item here, what I'd like to do with the board's consent is direct staff to incorporate the new language and post this document on the board's website. So with your consent, Mark, you are so directed. Thanks. Okay, next agenda item we have is public comment on notice of forest practices to affected Indian tribes rulemaking, which we'll next
no
visit.
Notes.
Staff. And we have one person signed for comment, Peter Heidi.
Thank you again, Mr. Young and other board members. First off, I'll take just a minute to speak from my position as co-chair of the committee and assure the board that this topic has been before the Cultural Committee, the Cultural Resources Committee, for some time, and that we moved it. Actually, the report we presented to you was our first quarter report. We had one meeting since then, and we moved this item up to a high priority, so I can assure you that we will be working on it. Now, speaking from my position as a policy director for Forest and for Washington Forest Protection Association, I've got just a couple of things to say. First of all, this particular rule has a history. It was essentially the language that's in the rules now was language that was developed during the original TFW agreement in 1987. It was designed specifically to provide a vehicle for the tribes to work directly with landowners during four issues, four cultural resource issues, which were the kinds of issues that did not fit well into archaeology and historic sites, kinds of issues that the tribes, in my belief, didn't necessarily want to have the state of Washington government involved with, but which they required some protection for, and they wished to consult directly with the landowners to achieve that protection. So the rule does have a history. It actually was brought to our committee. Concerns about the rule were brought to our committee by a member of our cultural director for the Cowlitz tribe, who was concerned that the rule in some way directed or attempted to direct tribes to participate in a, essentially a meeting with landowners, which the tribes wouldn't always want to participate in. In other words, not every issue that's brought to their attention is an issue that they feel that they want to participate in. So there was actually the concern was brought to us from the tribes. the committee worked on a solution to that and presented to DNR with the expectation that it would come to you and the board. Well, it turns out DNR had some additional problems that have arisen in the implementation of this rule, and I won't go into those problems because they're complex and sometimes difficult to understand. In fact, myself, I just last meeting we had in April was able to kind of sort this out in my head. I guess what I'm trying to say is this is opening a, I won't say a can of worms, but it's opening a rule that has a history. And our committee is going to have to deal with that history in developing a solution for you. We fully expect to be able to come to you with a consensus. I fully expect that the committee will come to you with a consensus proposal. Just a couple more things. The landowners wish to continue to work with tribes on these issues. There's no question about that. And we want to engage tribes. The cultural committee brought you the cultural resource protection and management plan some years ago, which was an approach to developing relationships and having essentially voluntary solutions to many of these problems, but yet recognizing that the state law that is in effect now around historic sites and archaeological sites. And the last thing is, we as landowners don't want to see the burden of proof shifted to landowners on these issues. It becomes very difficult and very expensive for the landowners to be trying to prove the negative. So we want to be careful that as we, and the committee will, I will bring this to the committee as well, but as the committee prepares that recommendation and you folks consider it, it's very important that the burden not be shifted for proving the negative on these issues to the landowners. And we definitely do want to continue working under the CRPNP to build those relationships with tribes and work with them on the issues. Thank you.
Okay, that concludes who's signed up to provide comment. Is there anyone else in the room who would like to provide comment on this action item? Okay, then that'll take us to the action item. Sherry, could you present that? Sherry Felix with Forest Practices Staff.
Good morning, Chair, members of the board. I'm Sherry Felix with the Policy and Services section of the Forest Practices Division. And it's my pleasure today to be here to ask for your approval to notify the public of a possible rulemaking on your rule titled Notice of Forest Practices to Affected Indian Tribes. That is WAC 222-20-120. This notice would be a CR 101 as required by the Administrative Procedure Act. Staff believes it's timely to file the CR 101 because your 2010 work plan includes this possible rulemaking, and as you have heard today and previously, the TFW Cultural Resources Committee is developing consensus recommendations for amending this rule. The Cultural Resources Committee is endeavoring to improve understanding and therefore implementation of this rule while respecting tribal sovereignty. To achieve this goal, the committee's work is focused on clarifying ambiguous language and resolving issues with the landowner tribe meetings that are required when applications involve cultural resources. If you decide to notify the public at this time, staff will file a CR 101 with the Code Revisor's Office. At this time, are there any questions?
What is the expectation of time regarding when the committee would get something back to staff and back to the board? Or is there one within the filing of the CR 101?
There is no timeline when a CR 101 is filed. In fact, if a rulemaking doesn't come to fruition, that's not required under a CR 101. So, and I hesitate to speak for the committee on a timeline because, as you heard from Mr. Heide, these are complicated and sensitive issues. The committee is pushing forward in what I feel is a pretty good timely manner given how complicated this particular issue is. Of course, the earliest that you could have anything possibly would be for the August meeting, but I would not expect.
Does staff have a thought as to what a motion might look like on this?
Yes.
I move Forest Practices Board direct staff to file CR 101 with the Office of Code Advisor to inform the public. And that the board is considering rulemaking to amend WAC 222-20-120. This rulemaking would clarify ambiguous language and resolve issues with the rules, land owner tribe meeting requirement, and tribal sovereignty.
Second. Motion has been made and seconded. Any additional discussion or questions for Sherry? Okay. If not, I'll call the question. All those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Any abstentions? Motion is passed. Sherry, thank you.
Thank you.
Next up, we have public comment on Northern Spotted Owl rulemaking. Okay, we have no one signed up to provide comments to the board on this action item. Is there anyone in the room who would like to offer comments to the board on Northern Spotted Owl rulemaking? Okay, then we'll proceed to the presentation of the action item. Gretchen Robinson.
Good morning, members of the board and Chairman Young. I'm Gretchen Robinson, and I too work in the Forest Practices Division. Is this mic working? I can't really tell. Okay. Forest Practices Division in the Policy and Services Section. And I'm here to request your adoption of the Northern Spotted Owl Rule. The entire rulemaking process for this rule has been completed, and the board has not received any comments on this rule proposal. I'll do a little bit of summary on what the rule does and some background for you before I ask for the action. This rule establishes a three-member spotted owl conservation advisory group whose function is to play a role in the decision of whether a Northern Spotted Owl Site Center may be decertified. The language specifies that the board will determine on an annual basis whether the group's function continues to be needed while the board determines whether additional rule changes or other strategies are necessary for spotted owl conservation. So for the benefit of the board members that haven't been with the board during this entire rulemaking process, I'll give a bit of a background. In your materials, I did provide a chronology of the board's activities in this rulemaking, but I can go further back than that. The rule is the latest of several actions the board has taken since 2005, actually. In 2005, the Department of Fish and Wildlife scientists reported results of assessments for the Northern Spotted Owl in Washington, and they reported declines in the spotted owl's population and its habitat since the board originally adopted rules for the Northern Spotted Owl in the early 1990s. In response to those assessments, the board adopted an emergency rule that imposed a temporary moratorium on decertification of spotted owl site centers to ensure that no habitat would be lost while the board considered a long-term conservation strategy. That moratorium was in place for about 3 years through a series of emergency and permanent rulemaking. Until in December 2008, the board adopted a new emergency rule that eliminated the moratorium language, but added a process in which a three-member spotted owl conservation advisory group would have a role, along with the State Department of Fish and Wildlife, in the evaluation of whether any site center may be decertified at a landowner's request. Also in December 2008, the board directed staff to begin permanent rulemaking with the same language. Originally, the board intended the advisory group to exist until December 31st, 2009. But last November, the Policy Working Group on Northern Spotted Owl Conservation recommended that the board change the language to an open-ended time period with an annual review by the board. So that brings us to the present, and that is the language you would be considering today for adoption. There's one additional point I need to make that I forgot to mention on my memorandum to you in your board materials. DNR has a relatively new requirement when the board is considering adopting a rule. It is related to the small forest landowner long-term applications. And these are applications in which small forest landowners can request to have up to 15 years for their application. And that was allowed or adopted by the board a couple of years ago. So when the board is considering a new rule, DNR must review all approved small forest landowner long-term applications and consult with the State Department of Fish and Wildlife, Ecology, and Tribes, affected tribes in this case, to determine whether any activities approved in those applications would be affected by the new rule. If so, the board would need to make a determination whether to further condition those applications to protect public resources. So for this rule, I am now reporting to you that we have reviewed all of the long-term applications, and we found that none of them include lands in the designated areas that may be subject to this rule. From now on, we'll put that, the results of that analysis in the memorandum before the board meeting. So with that, I would like to request that the board adopt the non-spotted owl rule.
Do you have language that would give effect to that?
I believe so.
Open for motions from board members.
I move that the Forest Practices Board adopt the rule proposal that amends WAC 222-16-010 and 222-16-080 relating to the Spotted Owl Conservation Advisory Group and elimination of the moratorium on Northern Spotted Owl decertification. I further move to direct staff to file a CR 103 rulemaking order with the Office of the Code Revisor.
Okay, second for that motion.
Second.
Okay. Further questions for Gretchen or discussions on this topic? Tom.
Thank you. I've got a new guy question. Who in here it mentions the board's policy working group on Northern Spotted Owl. Who sat on that?
Chairman Young, could you answer that question?
It was a relatively large number of participants, about a dozen total. There were representatives from state government, from the forest products industry, from the conservation caucus, a small forest landowner representative, and it was facilitated by a contracted facilitator, and the group worked for about 14 months from, I believe, January 2009 through February of this year. Something in that time frame, and produced a set of recommendations that were provided back to the Forest Practices
Board. A follow-up question about Mike. In this proposal, it looks at an annual review by the board rather than a moratorium date or a sunset date out at some point. Were the pros and cons of different approaches, I'm assuming that was discussed within this work group, and maybe why an annual review was chosen as opposed to just a sunset date?
Well, let's see if Gretchen can speak to that.
I actually only know what was in the report, but I don't know what was involved in the discussion.
I might, I'll hazard a guess on that, and that is that the board had been through a series of extensions of emergency rules to keep doing this while long-term strategies are put in place. And I would think that the work group probably felt, rather than set it up so that the board would have to keep adopting one rule after another that expired, they would just put it as open-ended, and at what time the board did have its long-term strategy completed, then they could jump in there and act on it and either continue that or not. Yeah. I think it had to do with just minimizing the rulemaking workload.
I would just add that if you were to have rules expire, as in this rulemaking, we needed emergency rules to make sure that the same set of standards applied while the board was considering this issue. Emergency rules are only valid for 120 days, and so that's a major workload issue for the board and its staff.
Thank you.
I guess I could have answered that.
Gretchen, thanks for the chronology. It's kind of nice to see that. And Tom, just to let you know that this process, at least as far as this rule goes, has worked fairly well, because I was at the two board hearings on this rule, and we had no public comment at all. So it was kind of lonely hearings. But it indicates that the policy work group was a pretty effective place to deal with these issues.
Any further discussion? Okay, then I will call the question. All those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? The motion passes unanimously, which brings us to our less public comment segment of the day, public comment on administrative appeals rulemaking. No one signed up. Is there anyone in the room who would like to comment on administrative appeals rulemaking? Then we'll proceed right to the presentation of the action item. Gretchen, we already have you here, so please proceed.
Okay. So now I would like to ask your approval to proceed with an expedited rulemaking process to incorporate certain aspects of natural resources reform that was passed by the legislature in the 2010 session. House Bill 2935 simplified the appeals process for environmental and land use decisions. In part, it eliminated the Forest Practices Appeals Board, which Mr. Kramer mentioned before in his legislative report. And so DNR's decisions that were appealable to that Forest Practices Appeals Board are now appealable to the Pollution Control Hearings Board. The legislation also standardized appeal deadlines to 30 days, and the effect on forest practices is that people who are issued stop work orders will have 30 days instead of 15 days to appeal. Also, the legislation made the defined term date of receipt the standard trigger for appeals timeline. Most of the proposed rule changes I sent in your board packet are related to those changes in law, and they apply to the notice to comply, the stop work order, and civil penalties. However, there is another DNR decision now appealable to the Pollution Control Hearings Board, and that is the notice of conversion activities. This notice was instituted by the legislature in 2007, but our rules have not specified any appeals process for it. So this rulemaking is an opportunity to insert information about that notice by adding a subsection in WAC 222-20050, which is the section on conversion to non-forest use, and also by adding a definition for notice of conversion activities in our definitions section, which is WAC 222-16010. About expedited rulemaking, some of you may not know what that is. Under the Administrative Procedure Act, an expedited rulemaking is possible under certain circumstances, including if the rule is simply to incorporate statute. And in this case, that is what this rulemaking is to do. So it's a process that eliminates the CR 101 step. That's the step in which it's called the pre-proposal statement of inquiry. And that's the step where the agency lets the public know that they're considering rulemaking on a subject. And it eliminates also the requirements to conduct a cost-benefit analysis and a small business impact, economic impact statement, and any hearings. So the first step in Forest Practices expedited rulemaking is to do something that's in the Forest Practices Act, that's required in the Forest Practices Act, and that is to distribute the rule proposal to the State Department of Fish and Wildlife and to the counties of the state and the tribes of the state to allow those entities the opportunity to have an early review before the public at large is able to review and comment on the rule. So that is the action I'm asking for today. So I request that you direct staff to distribute the rule proposal to WDFW, the counties and tribes, for a 30-day review and comment period. And if you do take that action, we will do that distribution very soon and have a 30-day public comment period where we will receive the comments from those entities. And then in the summer, prior to your August meeting, we'll report the results of that and the next step in the meeting.
Questions for Gretchen? We're open for entertaining the motion.
Well, I've been doing it easy. We all do it this time.
I move that the Forest Practices Board approve the rule proposal relating to the elimination of the Forest Practices Appeals Board and a definition for notice of a conversion to a non-forestry use for a 30-day review with the county's Department of Fish and Wildlife and tribes. This rulemaking incorporates provisions of the 2010 Substitute House Bill 2935 and the 2002 Substitute Senate Bill 5883.
Second. Motion has been made and seconded. Any discussion? Further questions for Gretchen? Okay. If not, I'm going to call the question. All those in favor of passing this motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Abstentions? Motion is passed. Thank you, Gretchen.
You're welcome.
Council, do we have need for executive session today?
We do.
Okay.
Very brief one.
So we will be going into a brief executive session, and then the board meeting will be adjourned immediately following the conclusion of executive session. So I would ask...
We can probably say that it will be at noon, because I won't take any more.
Okay. I would ask that all others except board members, council, and board staff please leave the room at this point. Thank you.